This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And of course, today is a very big day in our country. It's General Election Day. We're looking at a presidential campaign. We're looking at all kinds of offices in the state of North Dakota and around the country. And we'll be getting into that discussion later in the show. But we're going to start today with Kent Burkardsmeyer. He's a photographer and a poet, and we're going to talk about his new book, Stillness, Whispers from Nature, which melds his photography and some poetry. Kent, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm great, honored to be here.
Your life story is interesting to me. You were an IT executive working for a couple of very big companies, EDS and Microsoft, and then you changed course. Give us a little bit of your background.
Yeah, I started off in engineering. I got a degree from the University of Colorado in engineering and started off 5 years in mechanical engineering about the time computers were prevalent. And so I was getting my MBA and decided this. I really liked computers. So I switched over to computers, and EDS, Electronic Data Systems, hired me on. Started programming and led like 15 years with them. They took us around the world. We lived in Argentina, Brazil, and Australia, and then end up in Florida, which is where I live now. And after a while working with EDS, I started interacting with Microsoft. So they recruited me over to focus on selling to large companies like EDS and outsourcing world. So after 11 and a half years with them, and I went over to London and worked 2.5 years with Microsoft. And we were looking to just come back, my wife and I, and our kids were in college. So I always had this passion about photography, and I was looking for maybe a change, getting out of the corporate world. So I just started focusing more time on myself with photography. And when we moved back to the U.S., I said, let's just do a sabbatical, a self-imposed sabbatical for 2 years. And let's just do something. I'll do photography. My wife was doing a lot of volunteer helping out with like Boys and Girls Club, et cetera. And so we had saved up money, and I took 2 years, and 2 years has turned into going on my sixth year now. So it's been a journey I've really enjoyed. A lot of being free and just focusing on things I'm passionate about.
Well, a lot of our listeners will remember that EDS was H. Ross Perot's enterprise. And of course, Microsoft is Bill Gates. And the foreword to your book, Stillness, Whispers from Nature, is from the former general manager for Microsoft, Melinda French Gates, married to Bill. So you've got some pretty strong support there.
Yeah, it's nice to have a popular name help you out with connections. And luckily, the reviews have been very good about my book rather than just the foreword. So I'm very happy on that.
Kent Burkardsmeyer is a native of Bismarck, but he's been out of the state in various enterprises for many years, comes back to visit, obviously, because I think you had an exhibit that was at the Capitol Gallery earlier this year, much earlier this year.
Yeah, in fact, it feels like a long time given the way the year's been. But last year, in October 5th, did a joint exhibit at the Capitol Gallery in Bismarck with abstract artist Jessica Walker from Bismarck. And her and I had a show there for 3 months. It ended in the beginning part of January of this year, which seems like eons ago. So it was a really good feeling for me to co-collaborate with Jessica, and she pushed me in some areas in my artistic area that I had never been to before. We did some work that was joint work where she painted on some of my photography and I overlaid some stuff on her artwork, and we did some joint silhouette pieces together. So that was extremely fun, and it was always great to come back home and have a show in your hometown.
Yes, the Dakota Gallery, David Borlaug runs it. It's quite an enterprise in downtown Bismarck. Let's get to the book, Stillness, Whispers from Nature. Why did you want to create this book?
Well, as a photographer, most want to have a photo book, but everybody has a photo book. And so how do you be different? And so I put aside the idea of a photo book, and I just kind of had in the back of the head for someday I would do something. And beginning of the pandemic in Florida, we went into isolation the beginning, middle part of March. And I had had several photography trips already arranged, and they started getting canceled. And so I wasn't really interested in photographing sort of locally here. I had my mind set on some other places, and I started just getting a lot of anxiety, like most people did with the pandemic. And I just remembered how much being out in nature really calms me. So I started looking at my photos I'd taken, and I wasn't interested in really working on any or taking more. I just started sitting with them, and words came to me, and I started jotting them down and scribbling notes. And then I started sharing them with friends and started posting a few on Instagram. And I was getting really good response. And somebody suggested, gosh, you should put these together. And it's like the light bulb went on. It's like, that would be a great idea. That would be a good way to do a photo book in a different sense and maybe make it available to people who would feel comfort like I was feeling comfort. And so I just decided I would go through the end of May. Every day I created a new poem, just came to me as I looked at a photo, and I just sort of sat with it and just immersed myself back into the moment and dealt with things I was struggling with at the time. So then I decided I'm going to self-publish. So I love learning new things, and I decided to jump into that realm and become a publisher as well and a book creator. And I have enough material for two books. So the first one, Stillness, Whisper of Nature, I released in the beginning of September. And I'm working on the second book, which will be called Awareness, Whispers from Nature. And it will most likely debut first part of the year, late January, early February. So, and it's all material I wrote at the same time. There's no chronological order in the poems. It just, I kind of put them together as I was working with the images and in a flow.
Why did you choose that title, Whispers, and Whispers from Nature being the series and Stillness being the principal title?
I felt the stillness in myself as I was looking at the photos and recalling the moments in each place where I had taken the photos, and felt that that was the calling of how to release my anxiety and how to soothe myself and how to start paying attention and looking around. Whispers from Nature, kind of the collection piece of it, stems from a lot of reading I've been doing with relative to forest bathing concept or nature fix and getting out in nature. And growing up in North Dakota, I was always in nature, and the beauty of North Dakota still resides with me. I like more wide open scenery, whether I'm even in, as the cover is a picture in the redwood forest, whether it's that, it's still kind of vast in a different sense. And so the whispers of nature came out as there's a lot there. There's a lot that nature talks to us. There's a lot that I get talked to. There's a feeling of when I'm in the presence of nature that I don't always have, especially in the presence of a big city or in the confines of my own place.
Well, your book includes images from around the world, images from China and, of course, all across the United States. What's your process, Kent? Does a picture occur to you, or do you set out to find it? How does it happen for you?
It's evolved over time. I used to start where I would go and just have sort of this preconceived notion of what I want. And I learned that for me, the picture speaks to me, it comes to me, and it will be something that intrinsically catches my eye or touches my heart or something that will draw the camera to my eye, and I'll take that picture. And then oftentimes there has been cases, like there's several pictures in here from North Dakota, and I was with a friend on them and we went looking out. I was searching around places I remember growing up and wanted to go back and visit, and parts that really touched me. I probably took 2 years before I actually revisited those photos and polished them up a little bit and worked on them and to finally print them and make them available for people to purchase or collect. So my process is sort of time spent with the deal, get an image, think through it, let it sit, come back to it, and just work on it and let it speak to me of what it's going to be like. Do I need to crop it a little bit here, straighten, do some, you know, little touch-ups like that, and then I print it and see how it looks on paper.
Now, because of the pandemic, it sounds like you were restricted in terms of being able to go out and maybe go on these trips that you talked about and take photos. So in this particular case, the photos came first. You were drawing from a portfolio and then writing to them. Is that how this worked?
Exactly. I was just needing that moment to be. I couldn't go out. I hadn't taken a photo from March, end of February, until I think the first time I really took another photo was in September or late August. So I just wasn't compelled to get out there. Even I live across the street from the ocean, so even going over there would have been a little easy. But there wasn't a draw to it. There's more interest, and now I'm eager to get back out.
What was the most difficult image of the ones that you selected for the book? What's the story behind the hardest one that you had to capture?
The poem is called Spaces, and the picture are 8 blackbirds on a picket white fence.
Oh, yes. I saw it.
So the story of that one, I actually wrote about it in a blog a couple of years ago. It was 4 years ago, almost 4 years ago. It was in January of 2017. I went up to the Outer Banks of North Carolina with a group of local photography friends, and we had an early morning session. It was foggy. We'd been out early, and then the person that was leading it brought us over to get breakfast. And the breakfast was, we went to a 7-Eleven and got Twinkies or something. And it wasn't a very good breakfast. But as I was coming out, these birds were all on this picket fence on the side of the 7-Eleven store. And so I went to the back of our vehicle. I opened the trunk. I got out my camera, and I just started stalking in a way. I started going slowly up to them, just getting a little bit closer, but moving really slowly. Everybody else was coming out of the 7-Eleven looking at me, and they're like, man, he's doing the right thing. We should have done that. And so I took about 5 or 6, and I just got closer and closer. And finally, I just got the right composition that I wanted. And thankfully, the birds just stood there and just sat there, and they all looked away, but one looked at me, and I positioned so the stop sign is off to the right of it. So you have these birds lined up on picket white fence going left to right, and then there's a stop sign that you see in the background, and then it's foggy to the Outer Banks neighborhood. So that was the most interesting, probably the hardest one to get, and because I'm involving live animals, so it was quite fascinating.
You captured the moment. You described the photograph very well. It's 8 blackbirds on a picket fence, and they are spaced.
Yeah,
and it's a very interesting photograph. How about the most challenging verse to create for this book?
I think all of them were very challenging. That's something I'd never done before. And it was challenging from a standpoint of putting them down and then kind of working the words. And I didn't know anything about writing poetry or even composing or even laying it out and that. And so putting the words down, and I first wrote it to fit on Instagram. So it's very narrow space and limited amounts you can do. So that kind of influenced how I structured the prose, if you will, and then continued that. So that was the hardest. Then publishing it, swirl's very difficult. I wanted it to, I have it kind of laid out in a swirl sense, and that came into my head as I was writing it, but I couldn't do that initially when I posted it on Instagram. So I wanted something like that. So it was also adding creativity about how it comes out in paper and print.
So you were adjusting the typography. The swirl that you refer to is across from a photograph that is a swirl of sorts. And the typography as it appears on the page is a swirl of letters that create the verse that's on that page. The book itself is lovely. How do you pronounce the name of the publisher?
Aurea Levy. And it's Aurea Levy is a name my wife and I concocted when I was on sabbatical. And it basically kind of means new beginning, a fresh beginning, and in a very loose sense of stretching where we concatenated words from just some searches. So because I self-published, we had set that up as our LLC. My business is called KJB Images, and it fits under that as the registered name. And so I had that legal entity out there, so then I just created Aurea Levy Publishing to be the publishing company.
Well, it's a beautiful book, and when you self-publish something like this, I suppose you're very concerned, especially if you're a photographer, about how the images will be reproduced, you know, whether or not the quality of the photograph will be properly represented, and this is very nice paper. It's a very well-presented book. So how are you selling it?
I'm doing well. First, well, thank you for the compliments on it. I'm doing really well on the sale. I had anticipated I could probably sell 200 on my own, and that was what I was leaning out to. But to get to a price point, you really need to have a larger volume. So I ended up printing 500 on the first printing, and they're doing quite well. I'm very happy. I had a lot of pre-orders, so I'm pretty close to having covered my investments. A few more to go on that aspect. I'm going to put out some mailers and flyers for Christmas and get people. A lot of people have said they want to give these as gifts, so I'm going to remind people and try to do that. I have a couple bookstores, small independent bookstores in Seattle where my son lives, who's carrying them. David has them at the Capitol Gallery. They have some there. And then I decided to put them on the Amazon Marketplace just this week. This is last week. And so I'll probably drive a few sales there as I get some more comments and feedback and reviews posted on it.
One of the images that caught my eye was on page 27 in the book. The book is Stillness, Whispers from Nature. Mm. We're talking with the photographer-poet Kent Burkersmeyer. And that was a pastoral morning, a beautiful landscape photograph of a river in western North Dakota.
Correct. That's a early sunrise, one June in Little Missouri, and it's in Theodore Roosevelt National Park. I had got my wife up very early with me to get out to sunrise. Sunrise in Medora area in June is extremely early. And if you need to get there like an hour before sunrise to set up and everything and find your composition. So that's like 3:30 in the morning we're getting up. And so we had this wonderful morning. The sun was just gorgeous and just happened to be very still. And the very I just have quivers up my arm right now just thinking about lovely mornings in North Dakota. There's this youthfulness that comes back to me and just that freshness and the sounds of the meadowlarks, et cetera. So that is a very nice picture of North Dakota.
And it's a reminder that, you know, a snapshot is one thing, but serious photographers think about this for a while. You went out there, you set it up. I think Ansel Adams famously used to wait for precisely the right moment when the light was just right. So it sounds like that's what you were waiting to do as well.
Yes, and I have very fortunate when my wife comes with me for when I can get her up in the morning. She brings the coffee and the breakfast, and then she'll set up behind. And so I'll be out taking the picture, and then we'll just sit down together as a couple and then just enjoy the rest of the morning because the sun's now up too much to get any really good photos of my style. Or in the evenings, she'll bring the wine and cheese and crackers, and then we'll sit down and have a nice romantic interlude of sitting on a blanket while my camera's set up and I'm taking pictures.
Kent Burkersmeyer is a photographer and now a poet. He's the creator of a new book, Stillness, Whispers from Nature. It's self-published, and as you mentioned, you can find it in a number of places, including the Capitol Gallery in Bismarck or online at Amazon. Kent, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And I should remind our listeners that you can see his images at kjbimages.com. Next on Main Street, Natural North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Zarel's Jewelry, presenting It's a Wonderful Life, an evening with Zuzu at the Bismarck Event Center November 21st, featuring a meet and greet with Carolyn Grimes, who played Zuzu Bailey in the Holiday Classic, plus games, prizes, a silent auction, and a complimentary screening of the movie. Tickets available now at the Bismarck Event Center box office or online at eTix. More info at Zarels.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura is a biologist who loves to share his fascination with the natural world. He creates the essays that you hear on Prairie Public, Natural North Dakota. Today, his subject isn't a plant or animal. It's about streams and rivers that surround us on the flat side of North Dakota.
Look at an aerial photograph of most North Dakota rivers, and you're likely to see it snake across a landscape in sinuous curves. These are low-energy rivers, or meandering rivers, as opposed to the high-energy or braided rivers. And if you look more closely, you're likely to see evidence of old channels and oxbows, evidence that these river channels have moved. It might surprise the casual observer, but the water flowing down a stream is not all flowing at the same rate. Plus, the river channel itself is not symmetrical. It's typically deepest towards the outside of each bend. That's because the current is faster here, so it cuts more here. Conversely, the flow is slower on the inside of each bend, and sediments tend to settle out, creating shallow areas. So over time, the river channel will move. Most everyone has noticed a vertical bank or cliff on the outer side of a meander in a river. Also known as a cut bank, this is a place that receives considerable force of the flow. As a result, erosion flushes out the loose material and constantly erodes the cut bank and may even cause the bank to occasionally slump or collapse into the river. That erosion causes the meander to erode and move further downstream. The eroded material is then carried downstream, where it's deposited or settles out opposite a cut bank, where the flow is much reduced, forming a point bar. These point bars, composed of accumulated sediment, may support willows and other vegetation. If you follow one of these rivers, eventually you're likely to observe an oxbow. Oxbows, sometimes called cutoff lakes, are generally crescent-shaped bodies of water associated with streams that form where two bends in the river converge, creating a cutoff. Eventually, both ends of the oxbow become blocked off by sediment, creating a closed basin. Periodic flooding may occur, and over time, sediment in the oxbow accumulates and may eventually become completely filled in. I've posted aerial photographs of the Red, Cheyenne, Mouse, and Little Missouri rivers showing these features along with the text of this Natural North Dakota. I think you'll find them interesting. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, it's Election Day. We'll check in to see how it's going with North Dakota Secretary of State Al Jaeger. And Prairie Public will cover the election tonight. We'll get a preview from our news director, Dave Thompson. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Grand Forks health officials say they are concerned about the growing number of COVID cases showing up in the community. At a briefing with the Grand Forks Council, the health department's Michael Dulitz says growth in cases started out in early October at 33 per 100,000 population. Now the figure tops 170 cases per 100,000. On a brighter note, Dulitz says there are plenty of people willing to be tested. Public Health Director Debbie Swanson says there may be room for policymakers to better align actions with the North Dakota Smart Restart guidelines.
We've been asked many times if they're enforceable, and we've had to reiterate that they're guidelines. So making them guidelines that are enforceable would be one way that we could compel behavior in a direction that will protect the community.
Swanson says one example is how the city deals with smoke-free laws. Last week, the council adopted a mask resolution urging residents to wear face coverings. Council President Dana Sandy says he supports the resolution, but was a little surprised it was implemented directly out of a committee of the whole meeting. He says perhaps there should be a policy discussion down the road.
Ultimately, it was signed by the mayor, which I believe was 100% what we had discussed. And so I believe the city attorney did a great job amending it, and I appreciate the fact that the mayor signed it. I would just expect that we would get another bite at the apple when the resolution was changed.
Make sure to enjoy the next few days with the warmth before the weekend comes, because it's going to be a pretty big change in temperature, that's for sure.
That's Brandon Gale at the National Weather Service in Bismarck. He says for the next few days, temperatures will be in the 60s and 70s. But that will change by Saturday. Along with that, Gale says the Weather Service is watching a storm system that could bring snow to parts of the state this weekend.
It's looking like most North Dakota is going to see precipitation, but in terms of what exactly that is, like rain or snow, we're not sure. Right now, the northwestern part of the state has the best chance of seeing accumulating snow, and into Montana as well. But that doesn't mean that that can't change over the next few days. It's just something we have to keep an eye on.
The Weather Service says highs on Saturday could be in the teens and 20s in western and central North Dakota. And polls are open across Minnesota. They will remain open until 8 p.m. Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon says it's already an election with historically high numbers of mail-in and absentee ballots. He says at the end of today, turnout may approach the state's turnout record of 83% sent back in 1956.
It's pretty electric out there right now, on all sides, by the way. I think on the left, right, people are fired up to vote. So it would not surprise me for us to smash the 77% modern day mark and perhaps exceed, even bust past the 80% cap.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by the man of the hour of the day. That's Al Jaeger. He's North Dakota Secretary of State. He's in charge of elections for North Dakota. Thanks for being with us, Al.
Well, good afternoon, Doug. It's good to be with you.
Well, this is an election year unlike any in my memory. How would you characterize the turnout?
Well, the turnout so far really is very interesting because as of yesterday, we had 270,000 people approximately that voted prior to Election Day, and that is very significant. If we compare that against the total turnout 4 years ago, which was approximately 350,000, it means that as we compare it against that, about 71-72% of the vote has already been cast as of yesterday. But today it's also very busy. Because of our new voting system and some of the things that we're able to do that where we can track it internally, we know that another 50,000 people have voted by at this time, and we still have a few hours left when the polling locations are still open. So, you know, right now we're getting up there close to 325,000 I would suspect we'll match 4 years ago, and maybe we'll even go a little bit higher than that.
You mentioned the early voting, that was voting by mail and early voting. Actually, the polls were opened a couple of weeks early. Can you break down how much of that 270,000 in earlier voting is by mail, and how much was people going to the polls?
Well, early voting was a little over 87,000. The number of ballots that were mailed in or through what we would call vote by mail or absentee, that amounted to just a little over 183,000. So, you know, it's, you know, a lot of mail has come in. And when we look at those numbers again, comparing it to 4 years ago, 4 years ago, we had about a third of the vote that was prior to Election Day, either by early voting or by absentee. And so the fact that we're now, you know, up into almost a two-thirds, well, not two-thirds, 75% range, that's quite a difference compared to 4 years ago.
And, of course, 4 years ago we didn't have a pandemic, which made those mail-in votes probably more interesting to a lot of people. In terms of the polling sites today, you mentioned that you've got tens of thousands of votes already in from people showing up on election day today. Are they crowded or is it quick in and out? How would you characterize that?
Well, right now, from what we're hearing, everything is going quite smooth. I'm not aware of any lines. It seems to be working very well. I think it's a reflection on the numbers that we have, and I don't think that we're having any problems with lines or anything like that. And some of the polls are open till 8 o'clock tonight, and if people haven't voted and are still wondering where to vote, we would encourage them to go to our website, which is vote.nd.gov, and there's a couple places where they can click and they can put in their house number and zip code, and it'll bring up all of the addresses in that zip code with that house number and zip code, and you just scroll down, find your address, kind of move to the right, and you'll be able to find out where your polling location is, what the hours are, and just about everything you need to know. Even if you haven't seen it yet, you can view a sample ballot that matches your residential address, and it works quite well.
So when they find that polling place, if they haven't voted yet, and a few people probably haven't, what do they need to have when they go to the polling place?
Well, in North Dakota, they do need a state-issued identification, which most people have a driver's license, and if they don't, and other people have a non-driver's license, both a non-driver's identification card, and both of those are through DOT, and you bring that, and if for some reason the address on those two items don't match where you live now, if you bring something like a utility bill or something that would indicate what your current address is, that would work. We have had reports of people who have lived in North Dakota for a while, but for reasons that only they know, haven't obtained a North Dakota issued identification and want to vote with, for instance, a Minnesota driver's license or, some out-of-state driver's license. By North Dakota law, that can't be accepted. And so in some cases, people have, waited for a long time. But on the other hand, based on our numbers, we're approaching, 340,000 people who have correctly provided the identification and are, have either cast their vote or, are casting it today.
So when does the counting start? Because you've got these tens of thousands of votes that came in from early voting and mail and absentee ballots. Have those been tabulated at this point and not revealed yet, or do they start at a certain time?
Well, under normal conditions, absentee ballots would be start processing yesterday, but with the governor's executive order that he did a couple weeks ago, the counties could start processing the absentee ballots last Thursday, and some of them did. And essentially that process is to, take the return envelope on the outside. Of course, the voter has signed their name. There's a comparison made to when they applied for the ballot, because in North Dakota we don't automatically send out ballots. The voter has to apply for it in some manner, and if those signatures match, then the envelope is open and the secrecy envelope is taken out, in which the ballot is located. That's completely separated from the return envelope, and then eventually those ballots are taken out of the secrecy envelope, put through a high speed scanner. At that particular point, they are being counted, but by law, the count cannot be revealed until the polls close tonight. And so there are no totals known to anybody until after the polls close tonight, and they do their final process. There's a secure seal, and then when, you know, that's when it's opened, and then those results will be transmitted through a secure network to our office. And as when they come here, they immediately show up on our results page on our website.
So when will we hear the first returns for North Dakota?
Well, I would think that with the polls closing at 8 o'clock, it's conceivable that, you know, sometime after 8, I would guess 8:39, that we will be seeing some results show up, and, you know, get progressively faster as the hours go along. But I would think with everything in order, we will know our state results pretty much as we normally do, you know, 9:30, 10, 10:30, you know, 11, those kind of things. At least at this point, I don't have any reason not to think anything differently. So,
will this election change the way we vote from now on? By that, I mean, we had this pandemic, which encouraged a lot of people to find another way to vote besides showing up at the polls on election day. Is this something that should be continued?
Well, it certainly could. I mean, more people might find that voting absentee really suited them well, and they may want to continue to do that. Obviously, we have a much higher percentage than we did 4 years ago in previous elections, and so there might still be people that want to do that and found that convenient. In terms of the voting process itself, even though we have a new voting system, which is basically a support system in terms of counting and electronic poll books and all of those features, voters, you know, are still voting on a paper ballot like they always have. And so voters haven't really, the voting process itself hasn't changed for voters. And whether something else changes in terms of how it might be done in the future, and what they've experienced this time that works for them, you know, there might be some changes there. So,
well, because of all the mail ballots that were handled this year, has that effectively increased the cost of the election?
Well, it possibly could. I hadn't really given that a lot of thought. One of the things that we did run into, and that probably can revert back to the way it used to be, is that right now we are operating about at half of the number of polling sites that we had 2 years ago. And with that, you in some cases have less people working, and you have less sites. But a lot of that was somewhat generated or caused by the fact that our election workers, a lot of them were in the elderly category, and you know, just chose not to work on an election board this time because of concerns with the COVID and all of that.
You've been at this for 28 years. You must have seen a fair number of changes in the way we handle voting. Give us a sense of the change you've seen.
If you go back into the 50s, which is, of course, is well ahead of my, you know, before my time, but you know, there was over 2,000 polling locations in the state, and I believe 2 years ago we were around 400, and so that has really changed. The thing that's really been helpful in this election is with the purchase of the new voting equipment. There are electronic poll books in all of the counties in the state. Certainly, the requirements with voter ID have changed, and I think they've changed to the better.
Al Jaeger is as experienced in voting as just about anybody in the country. He's North Dakota's Secretary of State. Thank you for spending time with us today.
You're welcome.
And coming up, we'll talk with our news director, Dave Thompson, about what he has planned for coverage.
Millions of people have already cast their votes for this year's presidential election. Many more are about to, some for the first time.
I wanted to be a part of the conversation, but the only thing I could do was talk about it. I couldn't go vote until I had my citizenship.
More from first-time voters and what you might be able to expect on election night. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered begins at 4 Central, 3 Mountain.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street on Election Day 2020. And it's time now to check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, who is standing by for a big night. Dave, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Doug. It is a pleasure.
How will our news team cover election night?
Well, we're going to be spending a lot of hours in the studio. And the reason we're spending a lot of hours in the studio this time is that there aren't the gatherings, the big, you know, parties, the victory parties or whatever. Because of COVID-19, the Republicans have decided, no, we're going to issue individual press releases and there's going to be contact individuals there. The Democrats are going to have kind of a gathering in Bismarck, but kind of not. And let me explain. What they're going to be doing is that they've rented some rooms at a motel in Bismarck, and if they get together, it's going to be socially distanced in a bigger convention type setting, but they're all going to be available in their own individual ways. You know, you can make calls and maybe get a Zoom call or something like that. So it's going to be a lot less one-on-ones for, you know, face-to-face for the news department, but we're going to be able to talk to at least the candidates later on in the evening.
So those typical election eve shots of either confetti or balloons falling or people marching to the mic with a serious
not
face to
time.
Say. Okay. What races in particular are you looking at?
Okay, well, the makeup of the North Dakota legislature might be interesting. I don't think you're going to see a sea change, but you have to look at a couple of key races. And, of course, the District 8 one is because David Ondal, who was one of the Republican candidates for the legislature, passed away from COVID. Now, his name is still on the ballot. And what does that mean in terms of what happens at the election? There is some thought that, of course, that the Constitution says, well, he's on the ballot. He may be elected, but they'll declare that the race was won by Ondal but has to be declared as an empty seat because he passed away. That would give the Republican Party committee in District 8 the authority to appoint somebody to replace him. There is another school of thought that says there may be a group that might go and say, hey, because he passed away, he shouldn't have been on the ballot, and it should be the third place finisher who's going to take that seat. That will be one to watch in the days following the election. Of course, statewide, you have to look at a couple of races. And given the amount of ad money that's been spent on the treasurer's race, that could be a little bit interesting in terms of the results of that one. And, of course, the Department of Public Instruction race is also one to watch. That's the no-party race.
Now, the governor's race is incumbent Doug Burgum, Republican, Shelley Lentz, the Democratic NPL candidate, and you have been mentioning occasionally the potential for a write-in candidacy for Michael Coachman.
Correct. There is a whole Facebook group that's been discussing the Michael Coachman write-in campaign. They're thinking that he's going to get a substantial amount of votes, but probably not enough to really tip the election. Again, we'll watch that and see how many write-in votes he gets.
Now, Dave, I won't dwell on this, but you're of a certain age. So am I. And you've been covering North Dakota politics since the early 80s. How does this cycle compare? Obviously, the pandemic's a piece of this, but what's your observation about this year's presidential election, the general election campaign in North Dakota?
It has been very strange this year, and a lot of it is because of COVID. There aren't as many news conferences. There aren't as many face-to-face opportunities for reporters to talk to the candidates. You can talk via Zoom, which is probably the next best thing about being in person. Rather be in person just because that's who I am. I like to visit with the campaign face to face. Well, with a Zoom, you've got electronics, and electronics sometimes fail, and then you're doing a lot more phone interviews, and yeah, it's a whole different feel, and it really didn't feel like a normal campaign at all to me. It was very strange.
You know, I remember in 1975, I was still wet behind the ears, and I was working at a TV station in Fargo, and there was a knock on the back door, and it was then Lieutenant Governor Rudy Perpich, and he wanted to know if I wanted to interview him. So we put him up against the wall, and we shot some film. For me, the change over the years has been that the candidates have become much more professionally wrapped, that they typically have statements that have been carefully vetted. They have websites or Facebook pages that are, you know, sticklers about in terms of their approach to various issues. And while they're not unwilling to talk to reporters, they're not quite as available, and it's not the same. The candor seems to have weakened a bit.
That's correct, and I do see that as well. And a lot of it, you can say, maybe it's COVID, but I honestly think that they really want to have their message honed to what they want to represent. And we're reporters. Sometimes we ask things that are not on that sheet of subjects, and sometimes they have to come up with things. But you mentioned the Lieutenant Governor of Minnesota, Rudy Perpich, coming in. I have one, too, and this was when I was a fairly young reporter, 1979, in the North Dakota legislature. And in those days, you could actually walk into the governor's office and say, is Governor Art Link there? And they'd say, oh, sure, go ahead and walk in. And that's how open things were. Now you have to go through some channels to get some appointments, that type of thing. And yeah, you react to it, and maybe you get a chance to catch somebody on the fly. But, I'll tell you what, up and through John Hoeven, when John Hoeven became governor, the governors would hold Friday news conferences during a legislative session. This is beyond the campaign, but I think it goes to your point, is that they'd hold Friday news conferences during a legislative session, and there was no agenda to the news conference. They would have a few things to say, but they'd open it up, and you can do it. Ed Schaefer was a good one at that because, you know, he said what came to his mind, and it was always kind of interesting to go. George Sinner the same way when they had these Friday news conferences. Now you don't have that, and, you know, I kind of miss that.
I do, too, because I do remember walking into the governor's office and asking if he had a moment.
Yeah, and normally he'd say, there, sure, you know.
And there's the famous story about the fraternity somewhere calling the governor's residence late one night, and Governor Link, I think, answered the phone.
I think that's right.
The good old days.
Well, the good old days, yes.
Dave, you're going to have a busy night tonight, and I look forward to hearing what you have to say after the fact when we have our regular Friday news chat, because this is a year unlike any other, an election unlike any other, one for the books. We're living through history.
That's very true. I think we're going to have a lot of repercussions after this election. I think you're onto something there, sir.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
This is Dakota Daybook for November 3rd. On this date in 1988, North Dakotans packed a jubilant Dakota field house. The citizens' homage was an observance of the state's 99th birthday and prelude for the upcoming year's calendar of celebrations and events across the state. The centennial fete was replete with politicians and patriotic citizens of all stripes. standing before a gigantic American flag, and joined by their wives were former governors Arthur Link, William Guy, and Alan Olson, along with the then current governor, George Sinner. The Fargo Forum wrote that 103-year-old Carl Paulson was in attendance in his wheelchair representing Dakota Territory Days. 99 other citizens, each representing both their birth year and corresponding year in history, filled the stage. The assembled crowd of boys and women, girls and men were rewarded with a standing ovation from the enthusiastic crowd. Fargoan and popular media star Boyd Christensen served as the master of ceremonies. Christensen was flanked by Fargo-Moorhead news anchorman Marv Bossert, Charlie Johnson, and Doug Hamilton. The trio representing the three television stations sat at replica news desks recounting highlights from the state's past. A centennial performer and Theodore Roosevelt portrayer appeared on stage in various costumes, bringing word-for-word TR remembrances of his time in Dakota Territory and beyond. The North Dakota Centennial High School Marching Band performed for the crowd and would later travel the state and even appear in the Tournament of Roses Parade in California. Other centennial music was beautifully sung by the West Fargo High School Choir, officially designated as the Governor's Centennial Choir. Many of the centennial participants are no longer with us, and many more have made their own life and contribution since. The land and its people live on. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Steve Stark. I'm Bill Thomas. I've enjoyed filling in for Merrill Pepcorn while he's been politically engaged. He will be back on the job reading Dakota Datebooks tomorrow.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Cook like a Hungarian.
90% of Hungarian households will go for the non-smoked sweet paprika.
Explore northwestern Spain.
I would say that Galicia is our secret garden.
And hear why South Americans have not trusted the U.S. all the way back to the founding fathers.
They felt that eventually Latin America would be theirs.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Wednesday at 8 here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on our show, Ferguson Books and More has stores in Grand Forks and Bismarck. And in the midst of the pandemic, a third location will soon open in West Fargo. We'll talk about selling books and more with Dane Ferguson. And Dr. Agnieszka Solberg is an interventional radiologist at Bismarck's CHI St. Alexius Hospital. That's a specialty that's overwhelmingly practiced by men. She'll discuss how she aims to make a difference with our Ashley Thornburg. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.